Okay, we'll turn it on. I guess we decided that we'll pick up with something you want, a point you wanted to clarify on.
Well, I mean, I think it's something we talked about yesterday in terms of how I view the sort of the gestalt of the lab in terms of its soul, and I had to think about it in terms of comparisons with others, because as we talked yesterday, I never really sat back and compared it to other models as much as how it matches up with what I want to do. But when I did think about it, the name that came up was that of Jim Rothman, who studies vesicle transport at a very biochemical level. And I find that fascinating, because it's nothing very intimately related to what we do at all, but I think the approach, in that there's a fundamental problem of biology, trying to understand how proteins and lipids get moved along in the cell and sorted to different places in the cell. And the approach has been molecular and biochemical, not genetic. And I find that a very gratifying approach, because it identifies the components of the system, but through functional studies. So it identifies simultaneously, I guess, the function and the component, because that's the approach.
Instead of this kind of maybe perhaps a two-step or a process where you identify, clone it, say, okay, here it is, and then, well,
exactly.
You move on to the next
exactly.
And let somebody else mess around with it.
So the classical biochemistry or genetic approach is you have something and you try to figure out how it works or what it does in terms of you have an enzyme and all your instinct is how this enzyme is regulated, or you have a clone and you want to know what the function of that clone. And that's, you know, that's a major, I would say, problem in the reverse genetic approach, of where you really take a problem of fundamental biology and you pick up components of that problem, but often you don't know what those components do. You don't have the functional significance.
And you may not even care, right?
Well, I mean, there's I think for a while you may not care, as long as you're cataloging and assembling the pieces, but sooner or later you need to see how they fit together. You have to move to that next level of functional studies.
Do you think that's harder work?
The biochemical approach?
Or the fact that once you get past the catalog, you might as well do something with the things now that you've identified. And is it harder to then do the functional?
It is harder. It's probably getting easier with time as people understand structural motifs in terms of functional consequences. One, from sequencing genes, one could always glean some idea about how things work. And with more insight and cleverness and whatnot, you could. I would think that it's an important goal for most molecular geneticists, is once they've identified something on a pathway, is to find out how it fits that path in that pathway and how it works at the biochemical level. Although many molecular geneticists are not trained in biochemistry, so it may be very difficult to move on to that level. Just as many, I guess, biochemists are not trained in molecular genetics, so they can't bridge that gap from the other direction either. I think that's where the functional approach is. I think best, again, I hate to use that terminology, best exemplified by at least this example with Jim Rothman, that's appealing to me.
And as you say, it's not anything to do with, it's not a matter of comparing content, it's a matter of comparing approach, and even perhaps it's some sort of, has on an ideological level, it's about why, or, you know, why one would be interested in biology and why one would, and what one wants to get out of investigating. Where is he?
He's moved a few times. He's now at Sloan Kettering. He's head of a department or something at Sloan Kettering.
I know I've talked about him with somebody before, and isn't that awful? I believe it was him. Greg Payne.
There are other people who follow a similar approach. Gunter Blobel does related things in terms of nuclear structure and function and import. There are major labs that follow that paradigm or whatever, but I think that's the kind of approach that I find.
It's actually somebody else. I've talked to somebody about is Blobel, to talk about his approach. If you wanted to say a little bit, maybe it's against
I think
you see his name or his labs work on it in a journal and you read it.
Blobel may have started with things more from the biology part, and more recently moving into the molecular aspects of it. But I just needed the whole thing just as a clarification.
Sure. And I didn't want to, because when I was listening to the tape last night, I didn't want you to think that, actually, maybe that's something I should have made a note of it to make sure I definitely got on tape, that I was talking about like some sort of role model hero
I understand
who's this
that.
Person and are you imitating them, but more along,
No, because I think that does identify one approach to science. Mm-hmm. There are a few scientists that probably conduct science with this approach, although the majority, have a probably a more basic approach.
I think it's also a kind of an important question to ask from my point of view, because I think there are issues about whether it doesn't matter who's doing the science and when and where. There's this truth to be found and we'll find it versus a much more, I don't want to use the word relativistic, but a much more subjective understanding of how science gets done, which is that the style and the personalities and the people actually affect content. And not just, as some sort of side effect, but people's values and approaches and mores, affect the kinds of questions they ask and how they go about finding the answers. So that, to have people talk about that on tape, these sorts of things, is, I think, worth spending some time on. Not that I have an answer, I have a position that I hold on who's right and wrong, but there definitely seems, those are the kind of extreme ends of the issue. So that's what I was really getting more,
That's, again, sort of also is a more philosophical question. Mm-hmm. And I want to borrow again from William Harvey, the mathematician. Did we say Hardy yesterday or Harvey?
Actually, I was thinking about that later, too.
Yeah.
No, I think you said Hardy, but
Harvey.
It could be my business. It's Harvey. We're William Harvey we're talking about, and I will straighten that out with the
Maybe something I need to double-check the name fully. It's something I read many years ago, more than many now. But it's sort of a mathematician's apology. Why engage in the game of mathematics and still consider yourself a functional member of society? And I have to justify my work, too, from that point of view. Why engage...
To yourself. I mean, to
myself, yes. Not to NIH or anyone else. Why engage in... the abstractions of basic research and spend my life doing that rather than either work in the clinic in academia or, for that matter, go and immunize children in Bangladesh or some third world country. It's a serious philosophical question.
That confronts or is a part of being a doctor.
Because I do have that other hat and that capacity to do that. So these are real life possibilities and options, and almost instantaneous. I do switch a couple of months, a year from one to the other. I could switch permanently. So I have to justify my role to myself very carefully. But the philosophy of it beyond that, that's a very complex issue in terms of, yes, we can say I can work with one patient at a time and maybe provide a little increment in the well-being of that patient, and or work in science and try to enhance knowledge, and that may touch on human health later on. I don't think that argument stacks up real well in favor of research.
Really?
And I don't think so.
I think it's a common one. That's, again, without any kind of serious
a common
study
dilemma?
On my part. Or a common
conclusion?
Yeah, or, yes, I'm doing basic research. I'm an MD, but I think that I actually am contributing something more basic and in the long term helpful to more people. And again, I'm not thinking of anybody in particular. I haven't read any studies.
I don't have data to that at all. I'm sure many other physician scientists believe that they may be more useful as scientists. Although I'm pretty sure that many other physician scientists are more stuck in science because they got to be disillusioned with clinical medicine. Mm-hmm. See, I don't have that problem. So that's why I really have a true option here. I don't have a problem with clinical medicine. I enjoy it tremendously, and I'm very effective there. Mm-hmm. I establish good rapport with patients, and that, you know, is half the problem right there in helping patients out. So I do have that dilemma. And I think my role may be more in, you know, in a way, I have a deep-rooted belief that excellence and driving knowledge per se in a very abstract form is extremely important. Mm-hmm. And I think people who can provide role models, who can train younger people along the same lines, almost like Aristotle or Plato. And, you know, if you can touch a few people and carry a tradition of striving to be as analytical and as innovative and as a contributor to new knowledge or new ways to understand existing knowledge, which is, again, new knowledge, is very important. I really look at it in a political, almost political sense rather than a philosophical sense, that if we can move society, human society, one notch further as across the board in the strive to excellence and to more intellectual aspirations, I think that's a tremendous benefit to mankind. And I look at it from that point of view. So I really don't believe that what we're doing with leukemia cells is really gonna contribute to leukemia therapy in a very real sense. It may, and I hope that someday it will offer a lot of knowledge about that, but I can't sort of hang my... stick my neck out for that, because if it doesn't pan out, and most examples in science don't pan out in terms of resulting in concrete health benefits, I would be a very frustrated and vulnerable person. No, I think of it more in terms of I'm contributing to how people understand things. I'm contributing to how younger students develop their intellectual skills in research. And that probably would touch them beyond that, you know, beyond the immediate results of experimental biomedical research. And if that is part of a bigger tradition that maintains that, I think the impact can be tremendous.
And you mean this is of them passing it on, or of having X number of people with a sense of what education and investigation and abstraction and analysis and
in
human
terms of
kind of endeavor is?
In terms of myself being part of a much bigger group of people doing the same thing, or at least achieving similar mm-hmm. results, and myself grooming younger people mm-hmm. directly to do that. Some of the best rewarding feedback I've had, people who teach lipid biochemistry and come and tell me, hey, we teach your papers in our courses mm. on lipid biochemistry.
Maybe there's a textbook in the future.
What?
If you're getting this kind of feedback. No, I'm being serious.
Yeah,
I'm
it's that kind of reward that I appreciate a lot. And also having younger people think about science in a different way, my bias is a more enlightened way, more productive way. And if you can carry that across the board and improve everyone's ability to analytically look at things and synthesize information, and they do it across the board in all their social functions, I think society will be much healthier. Mm-hmm. And I'm not only talking about the U.S. society, but the world society at large.
Do you see this as something that you learned from? Well, you wanted to shut up for a second, and you finish your thought.
Yeah. Coming back to the original question, I didn't go on a tangent here, sort of not to come back to
the original
point, which is that is my dilemma, and since it is my dilemma, I'm always trying to make sure that what I'm doing in science is unique. That if I'm not in science, there'll be a gap. Maybe a very, very tiny, small gap, mm-hmm. but there'll be a gap because other people won't be doing what I'm doing. And it's something I also transmit to my students, because there is always this scooped idea running around in science. We got scooped, or we're going to get scooped, or someone's going to beat us to the punch line. And I always tell my students, that's not what you're going to get in my lab. And make sure that they understand that. Mm-hmm. Because, one, we're trying to solve a problem, so if anyone else contributes to solving that problem, that's only going to help us. Mm-hmm. And again, it has practical benefits too, because if other people start working on our problems become more important. Mm-hmm. That's a definition of being important. And it helps us really look at things with other... no one's going to do the same thing we're doing exactly verbatim. They're going to either use a different cell line or a different agent or a different thing. Mm-hmm. So we're going to learn more. And in the long run, that's going to make our story even more solid. And so I always try to transmit that to students. And to me, that's important, that almost avoiding trying to solve problems that you put you in a position of being scooped, because that automatically implies there are other people working on that problem. And if they're capable, competent people, I feel redundant. And that's been a major steering force for me in conducting research.
Is it also maybe in a reaction to your sense that there's a lot of that going on, or too much of it? Or
there is a lot of science going on, absolutely.
That's just strictly, done, oh, they're doing that, that looks good, let's try it ourselves? Is it just that you think that, well, okay, all of a sudden, I'm trying to think I guess let's talk about gene knockouts, just because I keep running into it. Where there's in some cases there's a race who's going to get the
knockout first.
And let's say that there's, I guess, what, 50 so far? There have been 50,
And I don't know how many genes have been knocked out.
The first two that were done were the same.
Yeah.
And that was apparently this is hearsay from my point of view, because I have not read it or seen it, in that kind of direct way, but that, the two labs, it wasn't a matter of, oh, they're doing it, we're going to do this one too. They both came to the conclusion, this is a good gene to do it on for these different reasons, and boom.
Yeah. Well, we may always find ourselves in that kind of situation, but it wouldn't bother me.
Right. you'd still go on with the work or...
If that gene knockout is part of a general question about understanding how something works in a system, it's fine. You do it, even if you get scooped on that, that only helps you move faster and further and makes you think how you can contribute more to that and deeper. But it goes even at the level of choosing the projects in the lab. Not in terms of, definitely every student in my lab gets what I think is a new project, something that hasn't been done somewhere else, and that is unlikely that it's being done by someone else. But equally as important to make sure that it fits in a scheme where the whole scheme is a novel angle of things or a novel contribution. Maybe now is a good time to discuss how the lab is structured. I don't know if you... But to sum that part up, therefore, in terms of the philosophy, is I want to make sure that what I'm doing in the lab is not redundant. Mm-hmm. And that's important in justifying my existence in the lab. Because if I was in a race in a knockout experiment, that means there's someone else knocking out that gene. It means if I went back to the clinic, I'm going to be contributing something important. While if I'm in the lab, I'm going to be contributing something redundant. You could carry the same argument to the clinic and say, how do you contribute something unique in the clinic? My gut feeling is there's always opportunity to contribute something unique and different in the clinic. Maybe if you're in a super quaternary referral center like Duke or Harvard or something, there are many other competent people. But then there is really a lack of super specialized people, definitely in the world at large, but also in many areas of this country. And even in that context, I could contribute new things, because I've been through that. I know, I can't kid myself and say I cannot contribute. Mm-hmm. So that's an overriding force here. Mm-hmm. How has that helped structure my lab? I think that's a major reason, a major, steering force or guiding force in structuring the lab. Mm-hmm. Maybe my own excitement about some biology problems have dictated the themes we want to address, but the trying to do something that establishes a unique, I would say, use the word niche for us at an approach level as well as at knowledge level, mm-hmm. has dictated the structure of the lab. And the two things we do in the lab, if I can spend just a couple of minutes on that. We have two programs, one on protein kinase C and one on sphingolipids. And this is a major burden to me because these are two different disciplines now. Mm-hmm. And it's at the point where I'm exhausted, basically, in trying to keep up with those two areas, run two programs independently, almost independently. Yet I'm still not willing to give up one or the other. Mm-hmm. Both have turned out to be very rewarding. And my initial bias that they're good for the health of each other has panned out. Mm-hmm. Let me explain that. The sphingolipid story is the easier to explain. It started, I think we also talked about that, when we found that sphingosine inhibited mm-hmm. protein kinase C. We asked that, we talked about that, that do sphingolipids offer signaling molecules? And that's the story we have built. The answer seems to be yes in at least one, probably two situations. In the first situation, which is really the better developed story at this point, which we've been working on for 4 years or so, we have found that a number of extracellular hormones and agents turn on this, what we call the sphingomyelin cycle of cell regulation. We've termed it an analogy with the PI cycle. And this has resulted for us in identifying either new entities or new functions for old entities. We have a new enzyme, a sphingomyelinase. We have a new function for sphingomyelin now as an informational, as a relay or a switch. And we have ceramide as the messenger from that relay switch. Mm-hmm. generated as a second messenger, we believe at this point ceramide functions at least in part by activating a protein phosphatase. What's been tantalizing for us over the last few months is that we're now getting an appreciation that this pathway of cell regulation seems to be much more involved in negative regulation of cell growth. It's an anti-proliferative pathway. And from our very recent studies, we believe it's important in inducing programmed cell death. Now, why is that important? One, it's important for all the biology and all the implications of the biology, that now we may have new tools and handles on mechanisms that counter proliferative signals, that make cells slow down, that may even instruct cells to die if they should die. And this is of fundamental importance in biology. It's of great importance in cancer. And the way we think of it is those instructions served by the sphingolipids are important to allow cells to adjust to hazardous situations. If a cell gets beaten up because it's suffered hypoxia, ischemia, lack of oxygen, or some other stress, or some other injury, you don't want that cell to go on and divide with all the injury, because you get a mutated cell and that's sort of inviting abnormal function, even cancer. So these are the molecules that instruct the cells to slow down. There's injury in the environment or injury in the cell, and maybe it's time to start repairing that
injury.
And this
is, like, you think, as just an intracellular kind of thing, or do you think this is some sort of...
Well, I think at both levels...
biological.
At both levels, I think it operates definitely in response to cell-to-cell communication or environment-to-cell instruction, but probably is going to emerge that also operates as a sensor inside
kind of
the cell.
Federalist system, if you will, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
The federal government and the local government kind of working it out together.
Yeah, pretty much, I think. The instructions can come either from within or from without to slow the cell so that it can size up the damage, or maybe even some of the sphingolipids are the molecules that size up the damage. Mm-hmm. And if the damage is irreparable, the cell is instructed to die. If the damage is reparable, then the cell is instructed to start to repair. Once it's healthy again, those signals may fade away, or those sensors, and the cell...
And you think it's the sphingomyelin cycle that's kind of... I'll get this right. It's doing all those levels. In other words, it's the monitor and the messenger.
It's the monitor, exactly. So it's the relay. The sort of the sphingomyelinase part and the sphingomyelin are sort of the sensing part of it. And ceramide is the second messenger, is the signal that goes on to instruct the cell. Exactly.
One of the more recent articles, and I wish I could just... pull it right. Maybe it's the one that just is, you know, a 2 weeks old. Though it seems to be competing with the forbolester protein kinase C. I mean,
pathway.
That it's not the only thing out there. But
That's the.
Am I making the picture too complex?
No, that was my other point. Why I think this is significant.
Right.
One was the biology. The other is, where does this pathway fit in terms of other pathways? And the way now I'm trying to explain it and think about it is a major drive in cancer biology over the last 20 years has been understanding what makes cells grow. And the knowledge base for there is phenomenal. We have discovered, or scientists have discovered, dozens of players in those mitogenic pathways, the signals that drive cells to grow. All kinds of mitogenic hormones, stimuli, receptors, second messengers, protein kinases, transcription factors. The list is really extensive, and the oncogenes that have come in to fit with that have really solidified that structural conceptualization of mitogenesis. So, if I tell you, and that's something I tell students, you know, if I tell you that hormone X works on the cell to induce it to turn from red to blue. Mm-hmm. And I ask you, how does it do that? In terms of all the signaling and all that it turns on in the cell. The way to answer that is actually very simple. My next question would be, does hormone X in any cell system instructs the cells to divide or not? Mm-hmm. Now, it may be that hormone X, like thrombin in human platelets, makes platelets aggregate. Yet in endothelial cells, it may make them divide. Once you make that connection, you can bring in all what we know about the mitogenic pathways and understand how thrombin works. You can relate it to tyrosine kinases, diethylglycerol, calcium, protein kinase, the whole concept. Now, in platelets don't have a nucleus, but in other cells, thrombin will do a lot of those things. Your yield from investigating those pathways with thrombin is going to be phenomenally high. Mm-hmm. And the understanding you're going to develop is going to be incredible. Now, if I tell you hormone Y turns the cell from red to green, and you answer my other question that, well, no, hormone Y doesn't make cells grow. In fact, in some cells, if it does anything, it makes those cells stop growing. Mm-hmm. I can't give you anything as a structural framework to understand how hormone Y works.
I think yesterday going through the Watson Hopkins book, just, you know, I use it as a, it's way out of date, of course, but it mentions, gives credit to someone, I think it's actually in transcription, but in the regulation of that, there's something that actually turns things off. And in other words, it tends to work as a negative.
Yeah.
And this is like the only example, and this is, what, 86, 87, but of that. Isn't that novel?
Yeah. So basically, there is a paucity in understanding how a signal that turns off a cell works. And that to me means there's a whole missing black box of what's happening inside the cell. I'm probably, for the record, I must state that hormones X and Y do not necessarily to be primarily a pro-mitogenic or an anti-proliferative or anti-proliferative hormone.
You even mentioned that maybe the hormone X could be the negative regulator in another
cell type. That's possible. But as long as you're trying to match up... even many of the elements in the mitogenic pathways, what I'm trying to say is they were discovered because they are involved in mitogenic pathways primarily, or a lot of the excitement about them has come because they are either oncogenes or regulators of oncogenes or substrates for oncogenes or related to the mitogenic pathway, although they may carry out other functions. For example, thrombin can stimulate mitogenesis but turns on platelets. Protein kinase C can activate platelets but can induce cell proliferation. So there is a lot of different functions for even the same molecules. But the thing is, if you want to understand how a molecule Y that turns off a cell works, there is really, tabula rasa, very blank page there.
Now, can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
Why? Do you know why?
Why
would have just missed the point, or?
A couple of good reasons. I think one is, and that's, even at the biology level, because a lot of this work has really been driven initially by biology.
Mm-hmm.
Although now we're at a stage of molecular biology and biochemistry, a lot of the discovery was initiated at the biology level. You culture cells, take what's in the soup and find out a growth factor there, and then purify and So the biologists always turned away from things that inhibited growth.
Just because of the material, what they had to... at their disposal, it's, which are these things that they need to
always been great
and get them to grow.
Skepticism about things that inhibit growth. Why? I don't know.
What kind of mental block or mental construct is there?
I've heard it from many biologists who work with growth factors and that.
Just the name. Just the language and the semantics or whatever.
Whenever they came across an activity that inhibits growth, they would pursue the activity that promoted growth. There was skepticism, and skepticism generates more skepticism. So basically, things that inhibit growth were looked down upon in terms of,
It must be tougher to investigate. Something that's going to turn off your system, it's going to be a real pain in the neck, isn't it?
It is. I think that's part of the skepticism. Okay. It's very difficult to investigate. And I really haven't explored the roots of that. Definitely those things were there before I even started in science. So I definitely was aware of skepticism back in the early 80s about all those things. You know, even the concept, some of those hormones were called chalones, C-H-A-L-O-N-E-S. And, I mean, almost in a pejorative sense that if you talk about a chalone, it means you don't know what you're talking about. So they were avoided. I think part of it, yes, is the complexity of understanding the system, because it turns out that many of these things that inhibit growth actually sometimes induce cell death. Now that has been a no-no for cell biologists. Things that induce cell death are not real.
It's like suicide. It's like
well, now we understand it as suicide. But back then, I think cell death means you're not growing the cells right, or you're doing something wrong. You can't get information. Now, two breakthroughs have come in that have really sort of started rectifying the imbalance there. One is a conceptualization of necrosis as a form of the cell death that really happens when you, like, put a flame to a cell and burn it. And apoptosis, or apoptosis, A-P-O-P-T-O-S-I-S, which actually was formulated in the early 70s, but it's only picked up very recently. Again, because an oncogene was found to work by inhibiting apoptosis. So, but again, you need to sort of that kind of connection, the oncogene first, to understand, oh, this is inhibiting cell death, so cell death is for real now. And now, whenever I explain cell death, you know, this apoptosis to someone, even an undergrad student, it's so intuitive that cells and the body needs that kind of machinery to make sure that when cells need to die, they go ahead and die and don't injure the body in the process of dying. So that was a brilliant formulation, I think, that there is programmed cell death. One, two more pathways, more, I don't know. There is at least one biochemical molecular pathway that instructs the cell to go ahead and die. So that's a brilliant breakthrough.
There's actually quite a few Pew scholars, you know.
Working now.
I didn't know that.
But it's picking up. It's a hot area. Absolutely.
Could you attribute the change in, I mean, to whom could you?
I think
the... doesn't necessarily
the people
need to be so-and-so, the PI in the lab, but just maybe...
Wiley and Kerr, in 1970, I think, published the first paper at the pathologic level, distinguishing two kinds of pathology, cell death by necrosis and cell death by apoptosis. But I really think there's been a lot of work on... Well, I should actually say two things. One is this connection to BCL2, which is an oncogene that works by inhibiting cell death. The other is showing that this mechanism of cell death is associated with DNA fragmentation in a very orderly fashion. That, I think, sold people to, hey, we can reduce the cell death to a biochemical measure. I think that has been a very important, and I really don't know who is the first group to show that.
We've certainly given the future readers of this plenty to go on.
Yeah. Oh, sure,
that's
sure.
their job, not
sure.
ours.
Now, the other major breakthrough in legitimizing mechanisms of growth inhibition came with the study of, again, cancer. One was the P53 oncogene, which initially was thought to be an oncogene, and I think the consensus now it's an anti-oncogene. You can mutate it to become an oncogene, but its function in the cell is to stop growth. And the other is definitely the retinoblastoma gene product. And RB is also causes cancer by not being there, by being eliminated functionally. And again, the formulation for that started in 1970 with an epidemiologist, pediatrician, going through the disease and how it's expressed, saying, hey, this looks like two alleles have been knocked out. It looks like a recessive disease at the molecular level, although you look at the pedigrees, you say this is an autosomal dominant. And with the cloning, it was verified immediately. that sure. this is a gene that's missing in those diseases, and it's missing, and it results in cancer because it, in a very sort of general way, inhibits growth. So I think those two formulations came in to show that, hey, there are real molecules working to suppress growth, and the mechanisms of cell growth inhibition and death are real biochemical molecular mechanisms. Now, why is that important for us? Because I think that's where sphingolipids are currently look like they fit in. They may provide us with some of those tools that we had in the 70s and 80s about understanding mitogenic pathways. These may be equivalent tools in understanding all the anti-mitogenic pathways. This may also be the reason they were not discovered until now, is that they operate primarily when cells are instructed to slow down or to die, and people have been avoiding all that area of biology.
I'm also trying now to, in my mind, recall what it was then, the situations, you know, in you're working between the two labs that in other words, what are the, almost the accidents that allowed, and even, you weren't even maybe sure in 1987, 88, 89 about, oh, this is all this, you know, downregulation, it's not the right word, but this, the
biology.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's, that would have allowed, you know, to see this come out, and, and as well as...
In retrospect, everything seemed like it was laid out magically, you
found,
know,
yeah.
just to be found. But obviously,
I mean,
it's more our limitations in thinking that have actually delayed us.
I would agree.
It's funny, I mean, in this context, maybe we should mention the Pew, because when I wrote the Pew, it was actually the first month I was setting up my lab. That's when I wrote the Pew proposal. So incidentally, the month my triplets were born. I remember that distinctly. And the proposal was aimed at that global thing in terms of, hey, let's look at sphingolipid products that can be second messengers. And in retrospect, I think it took quite some trust in my abilities to fund me. But I think that's also maybe the tradition of the Pew, is that they weren't really looking like NIH does in terms of, you know, oh, is this well and proven and a... not necessarily wise, but a safe investment. And the Pew, I don't think, considered that at all, because if they wanted a safe investment, mine would have been the first out the window. And and I think, you know, there was definitely a lipid person on the committee there, and I think it took some insight and trust that, you know, lipids are important, and this guy may be qualified to look at the sphingolipids.
This is also maybe, well, this is a good time to turn over the tape.